Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by us, The Fried Egg. Go to proshop.thefriedegg.com. That is where we sell things. We've got lots of stuff on there. We've got some good merchandise, pullovers, polos, t-shirts. We also have our photography up there. That's a great place to purchase golf photos of courses that you might want to, you know, remember for your office, for your house, for your man cave, for your living room, wherever it may be. Go to proshop.thefriedegg.com and you can support our little podcast, website, newsletter there. Today's episode is with Wayne Morrison. Wayne Morrison is the, I guess, the country's most prominent William Flynn expert. So who's William Flynn? He's a golf architect. He designed a little course called Shinnecock Hills, you may have heard of, as well as many others in the Golden Age. So we dove in and talked all things William Flynn. We talked about Wayne's book, The Nature Faker. If you are a member of a Flynn course or a William Flynn fanatic, you should check this book out. It's got basically a treasure trove of information. And he talks about where to purchase it. You can send him an email. And it's a digital book, which is great because you have it everywhere you go. So anyways, Wayne and I talk in great length about William Flynn, the man, the golf architect, the player. And I hope you guys enjoy this. I think we'll probably do one of these about most golf architects if you like it. So let us know. And thank you again for listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. Here is Wayne Morrison.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
How did this whole thing start? How did you become enamored with William Flynn?
Well, it's hard not to be enamored with William Flynn living and playing golf in the Philadelphia area because there's so many Flynn courses here. But I was commuting to New York every day for work and got tired of crossword puzzles and cryptograms and writing failed screenplays. So I thought, you know, this guy William Flynn has designed most of my favorite courses in the Philadelphia area. Nobody really knows anything about him. I see all this books and things coming out on other golf architects. And I thought, well, why not William Flynn?
So where'd you start? What'd you do to start?
First thing I did was I reached out to Jim Finnegan, good friend of our families, and he's a prolific golf writer and beautiful golf writer. And I asked him, what do you think I should do? And he said, research. you gotta find whatever materials you can. He suggested I talk to David Gordon, William Gordon's son. They had a design team together. And William Gordon was a construction foreman for Flynn. So I reached out to, Mr. Finnegan's advice, I reached out to David Gordon and I said, I'm trying to write this book on William Flynn, but I don't think it's going to be more than a pamphlet because I can't find anything. And he said to me, what's your address? I gave him my address. He goes, I'm going to send you something. Wait till you see. So about 2 weeks later, in front of my house is this huge box. It's probably 4 feet by 3 feet. And inside were probably about 3,000 drawings that Flynn did on golf courses. So
you had decided to write this a book or a pamphlet on William Flynn. How long were you waiting or looking for stuff on William Flynn before you talked to Gordon?
Probably 4 or 5 months. And I wasn't getting anywhere. This was probably 98. So a lot of stuff wasn't digitized then. And, there's some great historical societies in the Philadelphia area, great libraries. So I started going to those. I found the papers of some important people at Marion, and there were some really interesting things there. I found the Dahlin collection, which is a wonderful collection of aerial photographs that this guy in the 20s and 30s would fly around doing industrial work and work for the federal government. I guess it was land management and things like that. But he also photographed golf courses. So in that was a collection of a number of courses in the Philadelphia area where he was based, but up and down the East Coast as well. So it just so happens there were probably 20 or so clubs that Flynn designed that I had old aerials of.
So then this box comes full of stuff.
Undreamed of riches as far as, investigating and trying to do a book on William Flynn. Probably the largest collection of architectural plans by any architect pre-World War II. I mean, I don't think anything comes close. Even the Tufts archives down in Pinehurst pales in comparison to what Flynn did.
Can you take us to the, like, you opened the box, like, what were you,
I could,
what did you do?
Like, well, after my jaw closed, which it was incredible. I mean, it was the key to the whole project, really. Without that, I wouldn't have been able to write a 2,517-page book.
Still going, getting bigger.
Still
right?
getting bigger, yeah. I just found out last month that Flynn did a redesign of the Tuxedo Club's original course. So I had to add that chapter. But Dan Wexler did a book on lost courses. And one of the courses he mentioned was, wouldn't it be great if I could find the original plans for Boca Raton South? Well, there was the routing map for Boca Raton South and all the individual hole drawings. It's everything he wished he had when he was writing the book on the Boca Raton courses.
Do you remember what was like the first at the top of the box, like the first thing that you opened up, or did you know immediately what was in it?
Like, I had no idea. He
I'm saying, when you opened it, do you remember what was the first thing that you looked at was?
Catansett.
Right,
there
at
was
top.
Right at the top were 14 of 18 hole drawings of Catansett, and there was an interesting revelation, because most of the people at Catansett thought that it was a Frederick Hood course. Excuse me, he was the inspiration behind the project, and he oversaw the construction of it, but he didn't design the course. The Flynn plans matched the aerial photographs I had, and we found some documentation that later on that corroborated that it was a Flynn design. So that was an interesting discovery of sorts, where we could find an attribute, could verify an attribution.
So the box comes in total. How many golf courses? Information did it have on it?
I think in the low 50s.
Low 50s, and pretty much really detailed. Like, what was the most detailed of the courses?
Well, of the the drawings we had access to was Denver Country Club, a redesign that Flynn was doing, where it was one of the few courses where we had his detailed construction instructions. So if you look at Gil Hance's drawings today, he uses, as a template, the Flynn plan, the grid map, or grid paper, where each box was 10 yards and on the whole drawing, and each green detail was 10 feet. So, and there was a list of construction, very specific construction instructions for each hole, the depth of the bunkers, the height of the mounds, all kinds of really interesting detailed instructions, because Flynn had a very interesting, I don't know if you know this, but he had a really interesting business model where he grew up being a great, really good player in high school, competing against Francis Ouimet, beating him most of the time. But he became interested in golf architecture, really, when he came down to Philadelphia. But he was a great agronomist. He was one of the leading turf experts and experimenters in turf grasses. He developed construction techniques and seeding techniques and bent grasses that are used even today. So, and he was a great architect. So he was really a one-stop shop. William Flynn Design Company was the designer, and Toomey and Flynn was the construction and turf grass team.
So they would consult on turf grass and build the golf course. Right. So their model was like, we'll help, we'll build you, we'll design it, build it, and then we'll also grow it in effectively. Right.
So, I mean, no other architecture firm back then was doing all those things and doing them at an elite level. So they got a lot of jobs that way. Mm-hmm. Flynn was also, Philadelphia was an interesting place to be part of the golf revolution in the United States because it was a little behind the other cities. We talked about this a little earlier.
Yeah, let's talk about that. This is something I wanted to ask you as a question, was how did William Flynn get to Philadelphia and how did he become part of this golf renaissance in the city?
He came to Philadelphia to be on the construction crew.
Because he was from Boston.
He was from Boston, grew up in Milton, Massachusetts, caddied at Wollaston Golf Course, and competed, really, I mean, golf. He was one of the leading high school golfers in the state, but he was also the captain of the basketball team, captain of the football team, and probably ran track as well. He was just a gifted athlete and really a brilliant, hardworking guy. So he came to Philadelphia to work on the construction crew. I'm not sure if it's on the East Course or the West Course. Flynn's brother-in-law, Frederick Pickering, was one of the leading golf construction guys in the country at the time. He, at the age of 52, married Flynn's 18-year-old sister, which even I don't know what it was like back then, but it seems a little scandalous today. And
seems like a bad guy.
Well, he had some issues for sure. The marriage didn't last very long, and he had some alcohol problems and was fired during the construction of the West Course
at Marion.
At Marion, and then Flynn took over as head of construction for the West Course. He was at the became close with Hugh Wilson, who was the member in charge of the new course, which is now the East Course at Marion, but they moved from Haverford to Ardmore, and they hit it off. You know, it was more like a father-son relationship, and Hugh Wilson was obviously a genius. He imparted a lot of knowledge on Flynn. Flynn and he worked together on a number of projects outside of Marion even. They owned the first public golf course outside of the city. They owned together and designed together.
What was that called?
It was originally called Marble Hall, and then Green Valley Country Club, a Jewish club in the area, moved from one location and purchased that from Flynn's estate. And then they worked together on Catansett a little bit, Cobbs Creek certainly, and Pine Valley after Crump passed away.
So the Philly School, I think this is one of the coolest. Obviously, everybody knows Philadelphia as a mecca of golf in America, but that reputation is rooted in the Philadelphia School of Architecture and the kind of a group of individuals that included Flynn, Wilson, the founds father son from Oakmont. And then also Tillinghast and George Thomas.
And Crump and A.B. Clauder, yeah. And, George Meehan. There's, some lesser names, but they collaborated. They played a lot of golf. The Golf Association of Philadelphia is an incredible organization, and it was from the very beginning. It was the first regional golf association. But the interclub play, really sparked a lot of movement towards better golfers. We brushed upon the Leslie Cup. So Philadelphia was a bastion of cricket. Baseball took a long time to take hold in Philadelphia area, and so did golf because it was mostly horses and cricket, which kind of gave Philadelphia an advantage in the long run because some of the Victorian golf with the steeplechases and the cop bunkers and things like that, were happening elsewhere. And then when Philadelphia started getting into it in the mid to late 1890s, there was a bit of a freedom of expression. They weren't tied to the old world clubs. They weren't tied to what was going on in Chicago or New York or Boston. And the Leslie Cup was, I forget when that was established, maybe 1900, sometime between 1900 and 1910. And Philadelphia was just getting slaughtered by New York and Boston.
So the Leslie Cup, it was Montreal.
That was later on.
They were
Quebec.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was Boston, New York, and Philly, and it was a team competition.
Right. It was really the precursor
and it's still
to
just
the
today, yeah. Right?
Yeah, but it's not. It's lost a little bit of its luster, like the Linwood Hall amateur event at Huntington Valley and the Hugh Wilson at Marion. They kind of have slipped away because all the college, you know, tournament season and things like that. But we
seems
were getting
like the Leslie Cup needs to be resurrected,
or well, you know, it needs to attract, you know, instead of the old guard, you know, players from the different cities, you know, could have a little bit of
flair.
Yeah. So Philadelphia just, you know, was getting hammered in all these tournaments, and they decided what we need are better golf courses to develop better golfers. And that was the genesis for Marion and Pine Valley.
So, you know, New York at that time had National Golf Links. Garden mm-hmm. City would have been around then, right?
Yeah.
In Boston, Myopia.
Right.
The Country Club would have been, Essex would have been around, but it would have been a different golf course then mm-hmm. than it is now. In Philadelphia, what did Philadelphia have?
Three cans of peas in the ground, pretty much, at Philadelphia Country Club. Not much. And, you know, we were late getting public golf going in Philadelphia. Cobbs Creek in 1916, I think that's when it opened, was the first public course in the Philadelphia, whereas Boston and New York had public courses long, you know,
Van Cortlandt
Park, yeah,
in 1894 or yeah, whatever in the Bronx.
Well, we had nothing, so we weren't developing great golfers, and the movement towards creating golf courses to promote better play, you know, really sparked the Philadelphia School of Golf Architecture.
So Marion and Pine Valley, two of obviously the most historic places, were really born out of collaboration and being tired of getting their ass kicked in a competition.
Pretty much, yeah. Pine Valley even more so a collaborative effort, because Marion was, you know, mostly Hugh Wilson. He was a rather sickly man, unfortunately, but he knew he was really tied into the USGA. He and his brother Alan Wilson, and they were CB McDonald hooked them up with the guys at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Forgetting their names for a second. They put as much effort into golf architecture as they did playing surfaces. Subsoil, below ground and above ground. And there was a guy in Philadelphia called Frederick Taylor, and he was a really interesting guy. He was also on the executive board at Pine Valley, and he developed, which is kind of an angled version of the USGA spec greens, and developed, he was really big into time management for large enterprises. And Flynn learned from him how to develop cost models to that would be very accurate, so he could tell a club, you know, what it would cost to design and build the golf course, and he'd be spot on. Whereas, and I don't know this for a fact, but
maybe,
so I've been
maybe some architects now could try and
benefit from that.
Find the model.
I heard there wasn't a course that Donald Ross did that came in on or under budget.
Everything over.
Yeah. So Flynn was attractive in that sense, in that he could really, you know, he took a scientific approach to management of his operations, and also how he approached golf design. He spent a lot of time on site. So, you know, whereas Donald Ross was doing 20 courses a year, Flynn was doing two or three courses a year, where even Rayner and Tillinghast were doing, you know, several hundred, you know, 200 courses or whatever. Flynn's only, you know, he only did about 80 designs. Not all of those were built. Certainly not all of them lasted. The land bubble in Florida caused the no longer existing courses down there. But today, I think there's only about 50 courses that are, you know, had any version of Flynn, whether it's an original design, a redesign, or, you know, a varying scales or agronomic work that he did.
With Flynn, I guess, you know, you hear the other names that we talked about, Crump, Founds, and obviously those two and Wilson are tied directly to a couple of the greatest golf courses mm-hmm. in the country. But then you, George Thomas and A.W. Tillinghast are in there. And why do you think that Flynn, despite his vast number of golf courses and sometimes the stature of some of them, is a little bit slept on in the world of golf architecture?
That's the question I was hoping to answer when I first started this, because I thought he wasn't getting the credit that he was due. You know, I would play interclub matches in Gap. I was a member at Rolling Green at the time, which is a fabulous Flynn course and not too far from Marion. And, you know, I'd play all these, I'd want to play the away matches, and I'd go to the away matches and I'd ask who the architect was. And most of the members would go, I don't know, why do you care? So, but I found out that most of the courses that I liked in the area were by this guy, William Flynn, who to me was I had no idea who he was. And so I started exploring that. Connie Lagerman, Flynn's daughter, was still alive for most of the, you know, I'd say the first 10 years that I was writing the book. So I was able to get anecdotes and a little bit of a profile of who he was like. She said that he was a wild and mild Irishman, that he could, you know, he loved to go up in airplanes and do death-defying stunts with the pilots at the time, but he was also
up there with Dallin.
He did go up with Dallin, and but he was a, you know, he was a really great family man. He was, you know, beloved by most of the people that met him. When he worked for the Rockefellers developing the course in Epicanico Hills, they let him stay in the big house with the family. When he was working with Albert Lasker, he was treated like a, you know, not like a contractor. He was, you know, they really had a high regard for him. He was apparently very well liked.
He came over. He wasn't from a well-off family when he came to the States, right?
No, he was born in the United States.
Okay, and he was born there, but his family was immigrant. His parents were immigrants.
No, right? they were laborers. Mm-hmm. The father was. Flynn grew up caddying at Wollaston, and but he married a gardener, and you know, she's in the the Gardner family in Boston is pretty well regarded. You know, I'm sure there's many gardeners.
I thought you were talking about like an actual gardener.
Chauncey Gardner?
No, like a somebody that gardens.
Oh no, the Gardner family. Maybe. One of those Brahmin families out of Boston. And so he married well. I mean, not everybody in those illustrious families were wealthy, but he married very well, and he was accepted into Philadelphia society. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at, you know, the movers and shakers in Philadelphia were some of the biggest names in industry, and the Pennsylvania Railroad was the first billion-dollar company in the country, and most of those executives were Marion Golf Club members or Marion Cricket Club members at the time. So, you know, his relationship with Hugh Wilson was, you know, sort of opened up a lot of doors for him. He was, you know, working on some of the big, you know, in any given city where he was working, it was generally the elite club of the area. Mm-hmm. If you look at Cleveland, it was Pepper Pike Club and the Country Club in Pepper Pike. Shinnecock on Long Island, it was, you know, the fanciest summer vacation spot for the New Yorkers.
Cherry Hills in Denver.
Cherry Hills in Denver, Indian Creek in Florida, you know. It's an interesting dynamic who his clients were. He didn't take on a lot of projects, like we said earlier. He only did two or three courses, you know, a year. Spent a lot of time on site. So he kind of was the precursor to Coren Crenshaw and to Doak and to Hantz, where they designed build teams. He, you know, as opposed to, you know, some other architects that just put together a plan on a piece of paper. And a contracting team builds it. He was on site quite a bit, and as a result, his courses were built as he, you know, if you took his preliminary or you took his final architectural plans, and you overlaid those on an aerial photograph, an old aerial photograph, they match exactly. So he was very precise in his planning and execution of his of his design work, didn't leave things to chance, so to speak, and had his own construction crew that went with him everywhere.
Toomey
and Flynn, yeah.
Yeah.
William Gordon and Red Lawrence were the head of his construction crews.
Who then later became a solo architect on their own.
And Dick Wilson he got fired once by Flynn, but William Gordon had him rehired later that day. Flynn came back from a trip somewhere and went back to Shinnecock and saw that Dick Wilson took some liberties with his plans and flipped out and fired him on the spot. Dick Wilson's brother was also on the team, so probably a combination of Dick Wilson and Dick Wilson's brother and William Gordon, pleaded, and Flynn hired him back. But he was very particular about how his golf courses
seems like
built.
He was very type A,
very much so. Yeah, and I think his courses benefit from his time on site.
Yeah, when you play a Flynn course, from my experience, it seems like one of his strengths was finding the best green sites and really maximizing properties by, you think about some of them. Lancaster is a perfect example where, effectively three focal points where the clubhouse is, where the 10th green is, there's a ridge, and then where the first green is, there's a ridge. And pretty much those three ridges control all but a few holes of the golf course.
They're hubs for the design, yeah. And Flynn did that in a lot of places. His plans for the Country Club of York, which he didn't get, was very much like that. That's a fascinating study, by the way.
Yeah, the with the Ross and the Flynn routing.
Yeah, they were both competing for the same job, and it had the same starting and finishing point because the farmhouse was going to be the clubhouse. So it's really interesting to see those two great golf architects, how they've varied in their approach to the same site.
For anybody that's looking, there was a Golf Club Atlas article written about that, I believe, in the last couple of years. And if you just Google that, I think it pulls up if anybody wants to look at that.
Yeah, you would have thought that maybe they were running, they ran in the same direction, or maybe at worst they were playing opposite directions, but they were mostly 90 degrees from each other.
And sometimes these, they had these effectively bake-off. That's exactly what a lot of modern architects hate, is having to do a routing plan for a job they don't have. And Ross and Flynn did it.
So it's a rare opportunity to just try to get into the minds of two celebrated architects, but who looked at the same piece of ground very differently.
What would you say some of the other strengths outside of spending time on site from William Flynn courses and characteristics that say somebody could pick up on at a Flynn course?
That's a good question. I think, from an architectural standpoint, he spent a lot of time tying the features into the ground naturally, to look natural.
Hence the name of your book,
The Nature Faker. Yeah, his daughter said he called himself that.
Oh, really?
I didn't know that was a pejorative term, because I guess there was some anti-scientific sort of effort going where people were talking about it was pseudoscience and there was something to do with evolution and fake Piltdown Man and those kinds of things. But Flynn was, self-deprecating. He never took himself too seriously. I don't think back then the architects took each other all that seriously. They would undo each other's work without very, Flynn redid Ross courses within a few years after they opened, or redid Tillinghast courses a few years they were open. And I'm sure other people, did the same. There wasn't, somewhere along the line, golf architects became rock stars. And are held in a certain regard, and the courses are held in a regard as well.
Well, that's the thing I've always heard about golf course architects, though, is when they came to town, they were like celebrities versus like golf pros. Like, they were treated much differently than, like, golf pros were treated like almost like dirt.
They couldn't go in the clubhouse.
Couldn't go in the clubhouse. Like, but golf course architects were always celebrities.
That's right. I didn't really know that.
I think for a while, at a certain time, probably around the era of Hogan, is when things flipped.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So Flynn, I think he was able to make use of his successes in the Philadelphia area, and his accomplishments in turf, that when clubs were looking for, you know, who should we hire, you know, he got the reputation as being an outstanding designer, construction guy, and turf grass expert. And, you know, why hire three different people when you can hire one person and get it?
Makes it easy, right? It's the all in one, the bundle.
Yeah,
bundle.
I think that it's right.
I think Comcast before Comcast.
That's right. He was up for the Rockefeller family when they decided they were going to redesign the Willie Dunn course that they had on their estate in New York. Went on a pretty long search. The sons were, you know, trying to develop a golf course in celebration of their father, who was a, you know, avid golfer, and they had their engineer, you know, do a search for golf architects, and he wrote this interesting letter to John D. Rockefeller Jr. There aren't really any good golf architects in America. The only two I could possibly recommend are this Donald Ross of Pinehurst and William Flynn of Philadelphia. And he goes,
man, just throwing shade at so many architects that are revered now.
Yeah. So I think, you know, knowing the Rockefeller family as I do, and knowing how, you know, what their approach was, I think they really appreciated the fact that here was a guy that was going to tell them exactly how much it was going to cost to build the golf course, and he was going to deliver it on or under budget. They were thrilled with the course he did. He stayed in, like I said, he stayed in their house, in Mr. Rockefeller Sr.'s house while he was doing that work. And the reporting afterwards was that he took them on a journey, you know, around the, it's one of the most beautiful places in America. But, you know, the course wound through this estate with lots of long views over the Hudson River and beautiful specimen trees and things like that. And it was a journey. And Flynn, you asked me, you know, what are some of the characteristics of Flynn? His routings are phenomenal. His use of the natural land and maximizing the use of the features at hand are brilliant. And I think that creates some sort of uniqueness about his courses, because every piece of land is a little bit different. And if you use the land rather than manufacturing, like today, you know, they have those big bulldozers and, you know, they replicate, you know, hole number three with green number B or whatever. You know, he really liked to use the site as much as possible. But where he would build things and create architectural elements, he tied them in to look natural. And that's kind of, you know, in a way, I think he's, you know, they look at some of his work, or people today look at some of his work and say, you know, he got a great piece of ground. Well, if you look at the Cascades, where it's not really a mountain course, it sits in a valley, but it's surrounded by mountains. That was an engineering marvel. I mean, I don't know how many tens of thousands of pounds of dynamite were used and moving streams and rebuilding land areas for fairways and greens. But if you look at it, you can look at the list of all the engineering work that was done. But you look at it, it looks like it's nature made it, not Flynn. So I think routing is key. The use of the natural features is key. And those are hard concepts for most people to go to a golf course once or twice, or even members at a club to really
pick up on.
Those are hard things to see.
It's not like eccentric greens like a Tilling or like a Alistair McKenzie or a Walter Travis.
Yeah, with flourishy bunkers and eye candy, so to speak.
Or bold external features like a Rainer course that were built up by steam shovels, or a Charles Banks course.
Yeah.
His architecture was much more almost below the surface in a way.
Yeah. He was an outstanding builder of golf courses. They drained great, you know. He had an understanding that the technology was affecting the game. You know, when he grew up, it was the gutta percha ball and hickories, and then it became Pascal ball and steel shafts, and better athletes were playing the game. So even in 1927, he said, if we don't do something about the ball, we're going to have to start building 7,500 and 8,000 yard golf courses. So he proposed around that time that instead of bastardizing and lengthening existing golf courses that would negatively affect member play at some of these, you know, old guard clubs, why not just have some geographically diverse 7 or 8 golf courses that the USGA would, you know, just hold their championships on? Probably would have saved clubs a lot of money and maybe make for a better playing experience on a day-to-day basis.
What's interesting is that's still being said now. Why don't we just build them a road of courses? And maybe, you know, everybody probably scoffed at the idea and said that's financially, you know, ridiculous. And then, you know, 100 years later, effectively, it seems like, God, they would have saved a lot of money if they had done that.
Yeah. So, you know, and Flynn designed elasticity into his courses. You know, we had a little bit of effect of that walking around today where you play a hole and there's plenty of room to go backwards, but you got to walk, you know, 100 yards back to get to the tee and then walk forward again. But he designed elasticity into his courses. I think I don't know if you'd agree with me, but I think most of his courses are more relevant today than some of his other contemporaries.
Well, I think one of the things that I've found, I haven't seen nearly all of them, I've seen a fair amount of them, is that the number on the card rarely represents how they play. Like, because of his use of natural features, a lot of times the yardage on the card isn't representative of how you feel at when you get done with a round. Mm-hmm. You know, where it's like, oh, that was 6,500 yards. It felt like 7,000, you know.
Or at Marion, for instance, you play 6,100 yards from the white tees and it feels like 6,800 or 6,900 yards. Mm-hmm. Some of that's because, you know, if you think about it, you know, on 1, 2, you know, 6, a bunch of the holes, you're 14, you're hitting into upslopes. So you don't get a lot of roll out of the tee shots.
Hitting from it, and a lot of times it would be you hit from a ridge seemingly into an upslope, and then the green is further up the slope. You know, I think a lot of that too.
Rolling greens like that a lot.
He was an architect in the aerial age when aerial golf was being born, effectively.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. Think about the holes at Marion, Pine Valley, and Shinnecock. Mm-hmm. The mix of, and this is a design theory and practice of Flynn's, the holes that you have ground game options on and aerial demands on, it's about 50-50. Mm-hmm. And he believed very much in shot testing, so he designed holes that rewarded the ability to hit certain shots. At Huntington Valley, you know, it's hitting fades off of draw lies or draws off of fade lies, that's often required. You think of the 10th hole at Rolling Green. It was intended to be a 260-yard uphill par 3 in 1926. I think they built the tee at around 240. But there he wanted you to be able to hit a low-running draw. And the ground before the green and the green itself accepts a low-running draw. So he, you know, we talked about some of the long holes today at Marion. You had to hit driver on a lot of it. And, you know, at least one par 3 around he wanted you to be tested with a driver on a par 3.
I think the par 3s would definitely be one of the things that stands out about his designs in general. There's always seemingly a good short par 3, but then also some in brawny long par 3s that are really taxing and, you know, in general, typically a pretty good variety. Mm-hmm. As opposed, you know, and I think one of the things is that he built par 5s that were more gettable.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, I have, you know, what people, you know, call a bias, but I think
you might be biased. You got 2,500 pages under you.
It's an informed bias.
Yeah.
But
well, maybe you're just more well researched in one architect.
That is very true.
You know, if you duck into someone else, you might, you know.
Even nobody interests me enough to do that. No, I'm just kidding.
You just need to move out of Philadelphia, and then you might, you know, then you might be exposed to somebody else.
Yeah, that's true. And that's maybe one reason why Flynn isn't as regarded as highly as some others, because his courses are geographically centered in areas that, you know, the population shifts in the United States aren't really around anymore. You know, he didn't do any. The only thing he did out west was a little bit of Denver Country Club in Cherry Hills. He did that Pine Meadow and and for the Cardinal.
R.I.P. Joe Lee.
Yeah.
The butcher.
It used to be so, there.
That piece of land is just a beautiful, beautiful
place.
Is it?
I've never been there.
Oh, I think the nuns, the Covenant owns it.
Yeah.
And they lease it to the Jemsicks, who own Cock Hill, too. But it is a wonderful, wonderful property. And unfortunately, not much of any Flynn is
remains.
That's
a shame.
Joe Lee took care of that.
A little bit of Flynn was implemented out of a plan that he did for the Glenview Club.
Mm-hmm. I caddied there.
But, you know, I don't even know if you think, maybe there's 25% of the course is Flynn. That might be
place,
generous.
That place had, I believe they had Colt plant.
Oh, is that right?
Ross plant. They have Flynn plants, and somehow it's none of none
it's a
of
bastardization
the
of well, yeah somebody. I don't know.
I
who.
Mean, it's a fine golf course.
It's a great club.
Yeah, it's a great club and fine golf course, but it's just interesting. You always wonder if you just kind of went with one of these, would you be in a different place? Because it's really a pretty interesting piece of ground for oh. Chicago.
Flynn didn't do, you know, he did a lot of ultra private clubs. So, you know, that would prevent, you know, a lot of people from understanding his portfolio and where it stands in the pantheon of golf architects. But, you know, like Ross had Pinehurst where, you know, anybody who was anybody was wintering there or, you know, it was a trip south. They were always stopping there. Flynn, you know, the Cascades helped Flynn a little bit, but, you know, in general, they were very private clubs that didn't get a lot of play.
Well, I think what we talked about earlier, too, is like it seems like a lot of places didn't even know they were William Flynn designs for a long time. Like, I had heard at one point, like, people thought Shinnecock was a Dick Wilson design.
That's because Dick Wilson went in there in the 60s and said it was his design. Oh, William Flynn was my boss, but this is really my design. And, you know, he's just total BS in hopes of, you know, generating, I guess, you know, other business.
So here's maybe arguably the best championship golf course in America. And for decades, it's masqueraded as a Dick Wilson design when in actuality, while Donald Ross is building his lore on all of his championship courses and Tillinghast, you know, Shinnecock is thought to be Dick Wilson.
Yeah, their first
course.
History book, it was a Dick Wilson course.
So, you know, this is also a possible reason why maybe he's not as well regarded is, you know, probably his most well-known golf course wasn't always known as his golf course.
Yeah, that's a great point. Even in Indian Creek, which is a very private club down in Florida, it's on its private island, you know, Red Lawrence said that he designed the golf course. So,
well, they learned that from RTJ.
Is that right?
I believe.
Well, they
so.
Learned well.
Well, RTJ allegedly, and I think it's from A Difficult Par, the book. He took the quotes. I might be citing this wrong, but he took the quotes from that Alistair McKenzie said about Stanley Thompson, and used them for his U.S. Flyers right after the Great Depression ended. And, you know, sent him around to every club in the United States with these quotes about what Alistair McKenzie said about Stanley Thompson, saying that's
about
what he
him?
Said about him. And, you know, of course, Stanley Thompson was in Canada.
Yeah, right.
Didn't see any of these flyers. And RTJ all of a sudden picked up all this work.
Well, that's interesting.
But look, that's what Red Lawrence and, yeah. and Dick Wilson did, effectively.
Let's talk a little bit about Indian Creek because, you know, the Lido was supposedly this great engineer. It was a great engineering feat and it was considered a you know, monumental design at the time. And now it's being replicated pretty closely up in, is it Wisconsin where they're doing that?
Yeah, yeah, right.
Well, Indian Creek was built on a piece of land that was 3 feet in, dead flat, 3 feet above sea level. Then they were dredging Biscayne Bay. Indian Creek became a development project, and they used a lot of the fill from the bay to build up the island. Flynn designed that. Every contour in that design above 3 feet flat was by Flynn. It happened in Flynn's mind, and he put it onto the ground. The clubhouse is 35 feet above sea level. It's the tallest spot in Dade County. And but you walk around that island and it looks natural. I mean, it really is. It's an amazing place. some of the best approach shots in all of golf.
While he was down there, you know, one of the, I always have thought of having seen, you know, done research on the Normandy Shores. He did do a public golf course right there, Normandy Shores, which was, you know, out on an island. And you look at the old aerials of that place, and it looks just absolutely unbelievable. And this is something that I found from your book. I just stumbled upon that, and I looked at it, and I'm like, oh my God, I got to go see this place. But you know, part of the thing is,
so it ain't there anymore.
The public courses that he did, they aren't. They didn't get the treatment of Pinehurst. They didn't get the treatment, for the most part, of Bethpage, where you know Tillinghast's work is largely preserved there. They fell victim to the 1990s and the 1980s, the 1970s.
Cobbs Creek is a good example of that. That was a, that, I mean, it's not a, you know, original William Flynn, but that was a collaborative effort by those Philadelphians that, and it was a phenomenal golf course. But, you know, a ICBM, you know, interceptor missile site and a driving range and, you know, changing dynamics in the neighborhood. You know, there's the course that you see today is a lot different than what it was, but it's going to be put back. And I think if that gets put back, the design intent of Hugh Wilson and William Flynn and Crump and those guys are going to be returned, and it's going to be as, I mean, it has, I think it has the potential to be as highly or more highly regarded than any of the Bethpage courses.
Yeah, that, I think that's the thing, is that Bethpage Black is the looming monster in municipal golf, and obviously everybody, and I think a lot of it's because of the championship history, but when you look at some of the other public golf great public golf courses that haven't gotten the restoration, or in that case a restoration, they are, you know, if those courses get the brush up, there might be a question as to what the best is, because, you know, you look at the greens at Bethpage Black and they leave you wanting a lot more.
It's a head scratcher. Why those greens? I mean, when you're designing a golf complex that's supposed to be, you know, gradually harder and harder and more championship of a golf course, with black being the pinnacle of championship design of that complex, the greens are, you know, there's a couple good greens on there, but most of them are not that interesting.
I took a trip to Cleveland Heights in Lakeland one time when I was in Florida.
There's one I haven't been to yet.
There's a lot left there.
Yeah,
there's not. It's not all there, but there's like definitely holes that you that looks like a, you know, something he might do. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's just interesting how the whole stories of these places work. Like that was the Lakeland was the spring training site of Cleveland. The Cleveland Indians, the owner probably got to know William Flynn from his work at Pepper Pike.
And, yeah, exactly. He was probably a member of both of them.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden he says, come down to Lakeland and design a course at my spring training facility.
Right.
You know, it's just wild to think about like the how, you know, these guys got around the country.
I didn't know that was the spring training site for the Indians.
Well, that's why it's called Cleveland Heights.
Well, I thought it was because of the guys from Cleveland.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I knew they were. I know they were Cleveland guys, but I didn't know that's where the site for the spring training was for the team.
Yeah, I believe that's
interesting.
The correct story. You know, now it was so long ago that I always doubt myself, and I didn't, you know.
I know what you mean.
But I believe that was the story behind that. But yeah, I mean, Cobbs Creek obviously could be a good spot where, like, you know, obviously it's being restored by Gil Hance and Jim Wagner and Hance Golf Design. Obviously, Jim, being from Philadelphia, spent a lot of time there, and I know he's put a lot of like pro bono work over the years. And
you know, he played a lot of golf at Cobbs Creek, and he was a fence member at Marion. So it's great that, you know, it's kind of interesting. You know, Philadelphia is an adopted home for Gil, and it's the home of Jim Wagner, and they take tremendous pride in the you know, the architectural legacies of Philadelphia, and I'm so glad that they work on many of the courses around here, because we're all the better for it.
Mm-hmm. So in your mind, you know, what are the outside of, we've talked about Indian Creek and Shinnecock and Catansett. What are the other top flight William Flynn courses that are of the first class?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, according to Connie Lagerman, Flynn's daughter, Philadelphia Country Club was his favorite course in the Philadelphia area of his original designs. And
they moved the clubhouse, and unfortunately the routing progression changed and the finishing holes is not up to the rest of the golf course. But I think Philadelphia Country Club has some spectacular, unique landform holes. You haven't been there, right?
No,
but the 16th hole is a downhill short par four with a bunker that was added later on for the 39 and open, right in the middle of the fairway, short of the green. That you have to carry that bunker, land it short of the green to keep it on. It's a very precise shot you have to hit. So it's a short hole, but it's a high demand hole. I think we talked a little bit about earlier today about the Country Club in Pepper Pike. There are three golf holes there that are really unique, and they're all world golf holes. The 12th is a par 5, the 15th is a par 4 with a elevated platform for the green sits on, and the 17th is one of the great holes in America. It's got an interesting offset fairway, so you have to pick the right line in distance. You know, one of the things that you see in some of the older golf courses, I'll say it, McDonald and Rainer courses, a lot of straightaway holes with very little offset. You really are just challenged on direction, but not distance. If you have an offset fairway, it's line and distance. First hole at Shinnecock.
It's interesting you say that, and you talked earlier about how Flynn was almost like an early iteration of Coren Crenshaw.
Mm-hmm.
Bill, when he talked about Trinity Force and how he wanted to test the best players in the world, he talked about how making holes that force them to worry about hitting the right distance and direction, not mm-hmm. necessarily in bending holes to create that type of thing. Not a dog leg per se, but just the way the hole just kind of gently moves a certain direction mm-hmm. with a fairway angled a certain way. That creates a situation where you need to hit a line and a distance rather than just a line.
It's a much more exacting test of your tee shots, and Flynn did that in a lot of places. He offset greens, he offset fairways, and his bunkering, for whatever reason, if you look at the bunkering at Marion, for instance, it hasn't changed. They changed a little bit on the second hole when they lengthened the hole. But the bunkering today is the same as it was, 80, 90 years ago.
What was his involvement at Marion? Obviously, he was friends with Hugh Wilson. He was a grow-in super at the West Course, and he was.
I think he was in charge
superintendent,
of
superintendent, right?
Yeah. So he was. So this is interesting. Also, he was. It's interesting because Hugh Wilson and Flynn never, documented who did what, and it was.
This
very
type A individual who seemingly documented all sorts of stuff, didn't document Marion Tour.
Correct. we know all the drawings are by Flynn, and starting in 1916 through the last bit of changes that were prepared for the 34 Open. But, Hugh Wilson was in charge of everything until he passed away soon after the 1924 amateur. And he was in charge of everything. So, he didn't have a shovel or anything like that, but he was the inspiration, the planning, and design. Everything ran through him. So when the club bought some new land and added the tee on 10 instead of crossing the road on 10 to, everything was on the east side of Ardmore Avenue, for 10 and 11 and 12, who knows? It was done in 22 in preparation for the 24 amateur. I don't know, how much of that work was Flynn's and how much of that work was Hugh Wilson's. They were,
seemed like they were thick as thieves.
They were. They like I said, it was like a foster father and son relationship. Mm-hmm. So I think they collaborated on that. But certainly work was done at Marion 4 or 5 years after Hugh Wilson died. The whole first hole was redesigned for the 30 amateur.
What were the things that he brought to the Pine Valley? Because obviously that was a huge collaboration. There's stuff that Colt did to help. There's stuff that Tillinghast, obviously, famously, the Hell's Half Acre was allegedly a Tillinghast feature. Crump was kind of the mastermind that brought everything together. But what were what are the things that Flynn brought to Pine Valley?
I'll start with agronomics. The course was went into agronomic failure. They were building the course on straight sand, and they kept they couldn't keep grass on the golf course. So I think from 1918 to 1920, Flynn was the superintendent at Marion and Pine Valley.
And at that point, it was like a winter club, Pine Valley, right?
Yeah. I mean, all those big shots from Philadelphia, they would go to Atlantic City to play in the wintertime because of the sandy soil and a little bit more temperate weather. You know, it might have been 10 degrees warmer.
It takes a train, right?
They took a train from Philadelphia to Atlantic City. It went past Pine Valley. George Crump looked out the window and said,
"Does it still go past Pine Valley?"
I don't think it's not a passenger train anymore. I think when you're driving to Pine Valley, you have to go over railroad tracks, and then after driving past a schlocky water park,
Splash World,
and you get into Pine Valley, and all of a sudden it's like like Dorothy must have fell in the Wizard of Oz, because it's an incredible place and a feel to Pine Valley. But Flynn did a fair amount of work there. After Crump passed away and he committed suicide, there was a committee that was formed to sort of compile their reminiscences of what Crump wanted to do. And Hugh Wilson and Flynn and a few others worked together to implement those. 12 through 15 weren't finished. So Flynn did the bunkering below the second green. He did the bunkering below the 18th green, neither of which exist today. They were modified by a modern architect. And Flynn built the 17th green. He built the right green on 9 with George Thomas. And a few other things. He took the pimple out of the green on 18. But Toomey was on the executive committee at Pine Valley, and Flynn was a member from the very beginning. So that's another example where, you know, here's this this guy from a blue-collar Boston town comes to Philadelphia, and he's a founding member of one of the, premier clubs in the world.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen too many places. But, Quaker Philadelphia is there, we're sort of, hopefully we still have the, we're open-minded and we celebrate anybody that works hard and has some talent. And, Flynn was certainly that.
Yeah. Going back to your book, this is where it started. And I went on numerous tangents, as I often do. The book, it's 2,517
at the moment.
2,517. How did you start? How did you put this together?
Boy, it's interesting because, when I started, I guess it was 98 or 99, there wasn't much that was digitized and online. I mean, I don't even know what kind of modem I had back then. It was hard to,
dial up, probably.
Yeah, you had to wait for, a page to load.
Everybody remembers AOL, right? That sign in.
So there wasn't that much information, that it was available like there is today, newspapers.com and magazines that are digitized and things like that. I mean, I'm still constantly mining those sources.
Do you have like alerts or something?
No, but I probably should.
Yeah, to just go on.
I'm on the archives committee at Marion, and we have alerts for anything that comes up on eBay Green Jacket off auctions and stuff like that. But, there was a guy. I was an early participant in Golf Club Atlas. Got off it for a number of reasons, but there was a fellow that I really liked the way he wrote. I really liked his insights and he was immersed in the world of elite golf and elite clubs. His name's Tom Paul. He became one of my closest friends. Tommy, if you're out there, come out of your hermit cave and let's get together. But we went around and we visited all the Flynn clubs that, we didn't go to Denver and we didn't go to There's a Plymouth Country Club 9-hole small course in North Carolina that I haven't seen either. It was built by a member that he owned a paper mill, and he was a member at Pine Valley. But we would go visit the superintendents, and they're usually a great source of information at any club. You know, they're the go-to guys for preserving documents and things like that. And their insights are, tremendous, because they're maintaining something that was built by this guy 100 years ago. And it was kind of interesting. The clubs loved the fact that we were digging up information and providing them information. And, you know, this became something that was theoretical and academic, became very practical, because those historic assets are invaluable to architects today that want to do restorations or...
I imagine it's like, I mean... Anybody that's a member of Flynn Course or any architect who's looking at Flynn Course, I mean, the plans that you have in this book and the aerials and everything, I mean, it's pretty clear what needs to be done at almost all of them. It's just,
yeah, and
like I look at some of them that I've been to, and it's like, well, like, I don't know, really how difficult it is and how it's not back to here. Like, this is, you got everything you need to know right here.
Yeah, if you have the architectural plans and you have good aerials, I mean, you don't need much more. A good friend of mine, he does terrific research on aerial photographs. This guy, Craig Disher, who spent, hundreds of hours at the National Archives filming negatives and filming, taking photos of aerial photographs that the Department of Defense, the Department of Agriculture, and all those would take pictures. And these assets are available to clubs, but you can see when those assets are available and utilized what the outcome is versus places that didn't do it. And it's a shame. I mean, I'm not going to name some of these courses or architects who were involved, but if the goal is to historically restore something in terms of William Flynn, those assets are around. I don't know to what effect, to how much that's around for Rainer courses or Tillinghast courses or
Rainer
Gross.
Barely anything.
That's what I thought. You know, you look at the landforms that Rainer built, and I think of, Fox Chapel, for instance. You know, you could see where the greens extended to, because the tie-ins are not as natural looking as a lot of places. So in Flynn, you and I could walk around and get a we have a critical experienced eye to find these things, but a lot of clubs, it's not that simple. But I hope that if the mission is to do a historical restoration, that people would try to do the research. It's hard for these architects that are traveling all over the place and managing a lot of different golf courses to spend the 100 or so hours that are needed to really do a historical.
You'd think with how much money they spend and how much money they get paid that the historical stuff would be kind of a prerequisite.
Yeah, some of the,
like, 100 hours for, if you're going to spend $10 million on a restoration or $5 million on a restoration, 100 hours of research really isn't that much.
Yeah, that's true. I'm happy to make use of all the materials I have. I'm on the archives committee at Marion. Our archives chairman, John Capers, has done a phenomenal job in developing one of the real great archives of any private club in the world. And we it's open to members to make use of the assets, the hard assets and the digital assets that we've created. But it's also open to anybody, as long as you follow the right protocols to make use of all the materials we have. And we have over 230,000 digital files. About a third of that's Marion, but there's also digital files on a lot of significant American and worldwide courses. And it's really a research library, and I hope people make use of it.
You call your book more of a research book than a novel.
It's not, I don't think I'm a very good writer, but
nobody thinks they're a good writer.
Well, I think it's, I don't think I am a very good writer.
Then you probably aren't a good writer.
But it was meant to be. When Tom and I first started really working on this book, we didn't know the direction it was going to go in. We didn't know what we were going to find or anything like that. But what we thought about doing is, you know, clubs, I think modern clubs today, if any new golf courses are being built, take the opinion or take the approach of documenting the work and getting the architect to do videos and commentary on what they're thinking and such. So I take more pride in the book being a resource for people to, you know, have a go-to place for a William Flynn restoration.
Well, I mean, for me personally, I bought your book maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
It was only 1,600 pages then.
Early days of the fried egg. And for me, it was a huge resource. It was something that inspired me to go see more William Flynn courses and appreciate some of the stuff so much more. Like it was, you know, and then also like one of the things that I loved digging into was I grew up in Lake Bluff. In Lake Forest, he built a course called Mill Road Farm.
I'd like to talk about that a little bit.
One of the great courses that that no longer exists, and it was Albert Lasker, a rich guy who had an estate in Lake Forest who couldn't get into Onwencia or I don't
probably think anywhere else
anywhere in Lake Forest, and decided to just build his own golf course and hired Flynn, and it was allegedly, as you said in your book, the Oakmont of the Midwest.
It was 7,000 yards in the 1920s. There was I think Lasker had a standing wager, not really wager, but he would, you know, he was going to pay somebody, you know, with the first pro to or first golfer to break par, and it took years for somebody to do it. I think it was Tommy Armour, that did it. And it was an interesting, I mean, I don't know that area very well.
$1,000?
I think 500 or 1,000, something like that.
Which was then a large sum of money in the late 20s.
Well, Lasker was super rich. But you know that, I mean, the topography, it's relatively flat around there.
Very, very flat.
So what does Flynn do? Chicago. What does Flynn do in flat areas? He uses more bunkers to create interest. If you think about Shinnecock, where there's a lot of topography, there's not a lot of bunkering. But, you know, where there's not much going on, and especially, say, the sixth hole, for instance, that's about as flat as it gets on the course. Look at the bunkering and the sandy waste areas that he put in there.
Yeah, 8, 2 would be another good example. Mm-hmm. Everybody always talks about 9 through 11 at Shinnecock, and I always say, well, what about 8?
8's a great hole. And you know, it's sort of a counterintuitive hole, which Flynn did quite a lot of, where really the ideal line of play is on the outside of the dog leg. Mm-hmm. So when you talked about courses playing longer, if you got to play on the outside of a dog leg, you're adding, you know, yardage all the time.
Like that. Also, like 13 at Shinnecock would be another example, which is
that's a great hole that nobody talks about.
You see a lot of other places, and is, you know, similar holes. Another one would be 12 at Rolling Green would fit mm-hmm. that, where, you know, you play to the outside there of the dog leg.
You do that, you do that fair amount at Rolling Green.
Mm-hmm.
I just think his courses are enjoyably difficult. I mean, we talked about this earlier today. You know, you and I can design a difficult golf course, but who'd want to play it? You know, maybe we could do it. Maybe if we collaborate, we'd do better.
And anybody can make a golf course hard. That is true. But very few can make a golf course that's uber challenging for a really good player, but still playable for the regular player.
And
I mean, Shinnecock's the perfect example of that. Like, from what I've heard, it's a far more enjoyable course for a low trajectory player, such as a senior or a lady or a junior, than National Golf Links, which most male, you know, 10 handicaps and less would consider one of the most fun golf courses in the world. Shinnecock, which is a torture chamber, as we see for the pros, as they, you know, complain whenever they go there.
I think pros complain wherever they are, they complain.
Well, anywhere that that things don't go the way it normally goes on their tour, they complain. But at Shinnecock, you know, that golf course is as hard as it can get for a really good player. And then for, you know, an average player who plays along the ground, it's far more enjoyable than the course across the street.
Oh, I agree. Because, you know, I've seen, I've played Shinnecock many times. I haven't played National very many times, but you could see, you know, women in their 80s playing Shinnecock and enjoying it, like, and you know, having fun. It is an enjoyably difficult golf course. The more precise you get, the more penalty you have for missing. I mean, you see the short grass areas around the greens, which is something that Flynn was an early advocate for.
It's unfortunate that many Flynn courses do not have those short grass areas around greens.
Well, certainly the ones that were done before the mid-20s, he didn't do that very much. But then it started, you know, and that's how the book is written in chronological order. You can, you know, you can see the growth and the evolution of his design theories. It's really pretty interesting. Those short grass areas at Shinnecock, which were recently restored, create a lot of interesting decision making for the really good players, but for high handicappers or people that have difficulty hitting out of rough, the short grass areas are much more playable for the high handicappers. You know, they could use their putter if they worry about chipping yips like I've seemed to be going through these days. I got the chunk and skull down really well. But, to me, Shinnecock is the high water mark of that era of golf course design, because it is challenging to the best players and enjoyable to the all classes of golfers. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is the essence of great golf architecture.
So how... I guess, yeah, real quick on that, the U.S. Open, like the first 10 minutes of the U.S. Open or 20 minutes of the U.S. Open proved that with players playing the first and the 10th hole and where the ball was going on both of them, and just the sheer carnage right off the bat of what short grass does around greens,
yeah,
to good players.
I agreed. And, I was kind of curious to see, because, you know, before that there was, rough really close to the greens, and that's sort of how the USGA like to set up their golf courses.
It's how they still like to set up their golf courses.
So great credit to Charles Stevenson and the board and the green committee and at Shinnecock. They were dedicated to doing a historical restoration to reclaiming the interest and the shot varieties that those kind of short grass areas provide. It's fun. Because you don't have to just take a 60-degree wedge out of the rough near and try to pop up the ball, and there's all different kinds of shots you can hit.
All right, before we get you out of here,
that's it. We'll have to come back.
I know. Well, this is the first the first of the Flynn Chronicles or something. The Flynn findings.
The saga.
We can come up with some alliteration. Alliteration might be getting a little overused, but the first of them. Before we get out of here, what's the Flynn course that you haven't seen that you most like to see?
Cherry Hills.
Okay, yeah, it seems like one you got to get to.
Yeah, and I just haven't been I haven't been to Colorado. Most of my travels.
It's hard to get to Denver.
I know it's highly regarded. And there's some interesting holes there. I don't know how it stacks up versus the other Flynns in say Philadelphia. Or Pepper Pike, or certainly Indian Creek, Brookline. We haven't talked about Brookline.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. Can we talk? The U.S. Open's next year there.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, what was Flynn's involvement there? This is on my list, but I'm unorganized as always, and
Well, he coming from Boston, it was I'm sure it was a commission that he was thrilled to get. Early, they were going to expand the golf course. It was 18 holes. They wanted to expand the golf course. It's a big membership. Well, I think it's a big membership. It's a big club anyway.
It is a big membership.
And there's probably a demand for more golf, just like Marion had to, expand into their West course. But Donald Ross did a plan originally. A couple years later, Flynn did a plan, and the Flynn plan was chosen. Most people think that the original 18 holes were intact, and then the new nine was
the
Primrose nine was a separate golf course. But in fact, Flynn designed nine new holes, but created three separate nines that were mixtures of the new holes and the established holes. And on the established holes, he redesigned many of them. So there was quite a lot of Flynn there, but you know, they've had a lot of architects in the interim too. And you know, some of that Flynn stuff isn't there anymore. I haven't been back to see Gil's work there, but I'm excited to do that. I think some of the interesting holes, you know, some of the interesting landforms are really on the Primrose Nine.
Yeah, that par five that will be the 14th.
Oh, the uphill par five. Yeah,
yeah, the way that I forget, the Himalayas, I think they call it. It is just, yeah, that whole screams William Flynn.
Yeah.
Like it seems like it's just taken out of Philly and put into a Boston environment.
Yeah. One thing we should talk about at some point is these interrupted fairways that Flynn liked to do.
Mm-hmm.
That most clubs didn't want to see it built or got rid of it. But there was some of that at Brookline. But the downhill par four, I'm sorry, with the pond on the right is a great golf hole too. Mm-hmm. I forget, I don't even, you know, The routing progression has been changed so much, and it's going to be different for the 22 Open as well. But you know, you look at the bunkering, you look at some of the greens. It screams William Flynn.
Yeah, yeah. Just some of the way the land's used.
It's, yeah.
Reminiscent. I think that's one of the things with the country club at Brookline. Like the highs are really high out there because of the topographical interest
and the rocky outcroppings, yeah, and stuff like,
I mean,
that.
It's rocky, really cool, super cool. It's a really neat place.
So Flynn did two the country clubs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how about that?
Brookline and Pepper Pike.
They're confusing. Where can people get your book?
I think I have a Facebook page, but I hardly ever go on Facebook. Probably the best way, if they're really interested, is just to email me. Mm-hmm. Is it okay to give my email address?
Yeah, give it away. People are hopefully going to email you.
I hope so.
You're going to get probably a lot of emails from people at Flynn courses.
That's great. I'm happy to get it out there. The more people know about Flynn, the more people, you know, even in green committees and stuff like that, the better off their restorations are going to be if they realize these assets are available and will make them certainly available to them. But my email address is wsmorrison@hotmail.com.
It's a digital book.
It's
wonderful.
It's a PDF.
Yeah. It's one of the things I love about it is that you can use the Control F function. Whenever you need to, you just hit Control F or Command F, and it's a find. And like, oh, I've read most of it. I haven't read all of it.
You've read more than Tom Paul has.
I've looked through almost all of it. And if I ever am thinking, you know, want to see something, I just hit Control F and type the course name in.
That's what's great about a searchable PDF.
Yeah, and it makes the book a lot smaller.
Well, in terms of making things bigger, you know, having that on a computer screen and looking at the aerial photographs, the ground photographs, and the drawings are pieces of art.
Yes.
And you can really study them and see what was planned, what was built, and figure out what's there now. And that's really the only analytics that you need to do a restoration.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a question for you. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
What course of Flynn's that you haven't played or haven't seen would you like to see?
Oh, man.
Cherry
Hills, Indian Springs.
Creek.
Or Indian Creek. God, Indian Springs. Man, I'm losing my mind. Yeah. I think
Flynn did Indian Springs. He redesigned Donald Ross's Indian Springs outside of D.C.
I do, you know, there's a bunch of them that I want to see.
You got to go see Catansett. You got to see Indian Creek.
I want to see, I want a place around here that I've driven by a bunch of times that I want to see is McCall.
Oh, that, yeah. So that was a redesign of a Ross course.
Yeah. I've just driven by and I've seen some of the greens at the bottom of that big hill.
Boy, for a guy from Chicago, you've been around Philly.
I pay attention to stuff. I drive by, I see stuff, and I look at every time I drive by McCall, I like rubberneck. It's really unsafe. And it's usually at like before sunrise, and I'm looking, I see grounds crew out there mowing, and I see the big hill and these greens at the bottom of it. And I think to myself, man, that place looks wild.
In the city. And there's another course, Bala Country Club, that's also in the city, or Bala Golf Club, sorry, that's also in the city. Really short courses, but those courses are hard to score on.
You can,
It's amazing.
The way I understand it is that public play can be, or public play can play those at certain times.
McCall,
at least.
Yeah, McCall. I don't know about Ballas. You know, that's a course that's, you know, ups and downs in terms of.
I don't think those places are necessarily like on the inaccessible scale. I think with a little bit of work, you can go. Just about anybody can find their way onto those. Too.
Yeah.
You know, like that, you know, like Shinnecock, that on the accessible skills low. But that's the thing. It's like some of this stuff, you can, there are attainable Flynns that you can go see. It's not like, you know, if you want to go see a CB McDonald course and you don't have any connections, like, good luck. But yeah. Like, I think you can, there's places that you, that can be had in the Flynn, you know, directory that can, you can see great Flynn architecture if you're, say, from California and you mm-hmm. don't have any friends in Philadelphia.
Right. Well, somebody's playing, you know, some guests are playing these courses because, you know, some of these courses, it's a member and three guests mm-hmm. every tee time, just about.
Yeah. Yeah. But I the other one, I want to see the Cascades too. That's one.
That's
I
a fascinating
see.
Course if you know what was really, you know, what. That it wasn't just draped on the land, that it really was an engineering marvel to create that thing. Mm-hmm. Moving a stream that is a catch basin for 50 square miles, for instance, stuff like that. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And the greens, I mean, you know, Flynn's greens are amazing. They look simple, but they're really complicated, and they really are, you know, the long interplays of slopes that makes it hard to read and hard to judge speed sometimes.
And they're always benched into hills, which obscure the, you know, because he did so many, he built it into so many landforms. What happens is then by doing small little things, you can create these subtleties where that the green actually runs away when it looks like it's going, you're putting
yeah,
straight uphill.
Perceptual miscues.
Yes.
There's so many of them that they have to be by design, and there's some of them that are replicated, like the third green at Rolling Green and the fourth green at the Cascades. They're very similar, where the landform around that green is steeply downhill. So you change that pitch a little bit, so it really, in effect, is still front to back, but your eye makes it seem like it's steeply back to front. And, you know, putts in one direction go way past the hole, and putts in the other direction are way short because it's hard to perceive. You can trick the mind.
Yeah.
And Flynn was really good at manipulating the top lines of bunkers to accentuate that misread.
You know, and where that comes from, how you do that, spending a lot of time on site. Like, that's the stuff that the best architect, you know, and we see it today with the architects that spend the most time on site. Mm-hmm. Generally, those little details are in that. You know, people will roll their eyes when I go on, you know, I rant about little things, but, you know, those are the things that make golf courses great versus good.
And timelessly great, too. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So, hey, everybody check it out. The Nature Faker, they can email you.
Yeah, wsmorrison@hotmail.com. Or there is a Facebook page, but I don't check it very often.
I think I got it through the Facebook page.
Did you really?
Ago.
Well, maybe I should check it more often.
I'll have to find my receipt, you know. All right. Well, thanks for coming
this
on.
This was enjoyable. I don't know how long we talked, but it went by in like an instant.
Today's episode of the Fried Egg Podcast was edited by Meg Atkins. As a reminder, sign up for the Fried Egg newsletter. Will Knights does an awesome job. It's 3 days a week. Just go to thefriedegg.com and you can sign up there. It keeps you up to date on everything going on in golf. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Fried Egg Podcast, and we will see you soon. We'll be right back.